Hi, my name is Donna Malieri. I'm here from the Visual Studio F-Sharp team, where I'm the program manager. And today I'm going to talk to you about some new features in F-Sharp 3.0. And specifically, it's a grouping of features that we call information-rich programming. So let me just give you an outline of what I'm going to cover here. First, I'll give you an intro, because you may not have programmed in F-Sharp very much. This will explain just the basic syntax and just enough to kind of get started. Then I'll show you how we have some language features that help solve real-world problems. And we'll show you how the kind of design of some language features were inspired by the difficulties of getting data into your programming language. And I'll show you some demos, and in particular, I'll talk about type providers, which are one aspect of information-rich programming. Then I'll briefly talk about some future directions that we're looking at with F-Sharp. So let me start out with the F-Sharp tagline. F-Sharp is a practical, functional-first language that lets you write simple code to solve complex problems. Well, so the first part of the sentence probably makes sense. Complex problems probably also make sense to you, but what does it mean to have simple code? Well, generally what I mean here is that it's usually very concise and declarative, which I'll explain a little bit more later, and also kind of you get to express the algorithm as directly as possible. Let me give you some examples of what it looks like in F# to write this simple code. So in this example, I'll show you the command pattern in C#. Here we have an abstract class called command, and we have an execute method, and then we override it for two subclasses, the break command and the turn left command. Now, you all are probably very familiar with this pattern, and you can read through it pretty quickly and figure out what's going on. But the interesting thing is that there's only two lines of code that actually do anything, and that's this line here, execute for the break command and execute on the turn left command. But yet we have all of this boilerplate that we have to read through in order to understand what this code is doing. And sometimes it's not so obvious what pattern someone is using, and you end up having to read a lot of code, and then you're like, oh, okay, I see what they're doing here. And it's just extra stuff to read, and you can make mistakes. In F#, it's a lot more concise, which is really nice and makes it easier to read and understand. So here we define a type command that takes a rover and returns nothing. Unit is basically the same as void in C#. And then we define our commands, which we do using lambdas. A break command takes a rover, and it accelerates it by -1, and a turn left command is similar. The interesting thing is that there aren't any types anywhere, except for when I define the type definition on command here. Basically, F# has full type inference. So that means that you don't have to write your types anywhere you don't want to. And it's kind of like the var keyword in C#, except you get to use it anywhere you want. And it can be especially useful when you're talking about generic functions. So in C#, if you wanted to write some code to manipulate tuples, it ends up being very, very verbose. Like, for instance, if you want to swap, you end up having to write out all the type parameters, and when you instantiate, you write them out again. And it just, is a lot of extra code that you have to read and write just to do a very, very simple operation. In F#, you get to just write out, swap of x and y is just y and x, because F# has built-in tuples. And because of type inference, it actually looks at inside the code, the body of swap, and it sees that you're not doing anything with x and y that you couldn't do with any two types, t and u. So it automatically will generalize the type of swap, and it will come up with the exact same signature as in C#, except you don't have to write it out. And with rotations, you can see it's really useful because it is going to, there's, you have to repeat the type arguments four times, as in the C# code. And reduce, you just apply a function to a set of arguments. And here, even though it's doing something very simple, we still had to write out a lot in C#. So in F#, we get to have something a lot more concise. So I said earlier that F# is declarative, and that's what makes the code, quote unquote, simple. So what does that mean? Well, to give you an analogy from the real world, imagine you go to a coffee shop, and the way it works in this coffee shop is that you have to tell them exactly how to make your coffee, down to the very last detail. So you have to say, well, get some beans, make sure they're already roasted, and then grind them. And then once it's ground, you can put the beans into the cappuccino machine and, make cappuccino, and You'll make one shot of espresso, and then you'll pour it into a cup, and then you'll steam the milk, and this is how you steam milk, and this is how you know when it's gotten too hot, and all of these details. So this is really similar to how we usually write code. We usually have to write out all of the details. We don't get to say, this is what I want to do, because it's, you know, a program, and we have to write everything out. But the problem is, it becomes very tedious and verbose, and sometimes it's hard to understand what's going on amidst all the details of execution. In contrast, sometimes we get to write code that's very declarative. So, you know, the contrasting example would be if you go to a coffee shop and you just say, I want a latte, and not only do they give you a latte, they make a nice design on the front. And you don't have to tell them how to do it. You just say what you want. So to give you a concrete example from a programming language or a language you might be familiar with, you should think of SQL. So in SQL, when you want to select a row from a table, you don't tell it how to search in that table, or you don't tell it what the indexing scheme looks like, or any of those details. You just say, I want this item. Or if you join two tables, it knows how to do that, because it abstracts over all of those implementation details, and you just say, this is what I want. It figures out what that means, and it does it for you. Now, you can write code that's declarative in any language. You can imagine in C#, you could have some certain set of primitives, and putting them together would be very easy, and you could have, you know, some piece of code that is declarative. The point, though, is that F# makes it easier to write code that's declarative, because you get to write code that operates over lists, for example, without writing loops explicitly. So let me give you a few examples of some F# code, and I'll just show you the simple case of working with some sequences. So here I'm going to show you a very simple script that does a few operations on lists. So these are just some primitives to show the results. And here I'm calling a function called show, and this is the argument I'm passing. Note that I don't have to put parentheses around it, because they're optional if you have a one-argument function in F#. And here, this is an array expression. And it's saying, construct an array that consists of the range of the numbers from 0 to 25. And the interesting thing is that you can actually put a number of different kinds of things inside an array expression, which we'll see in a minute. But in this simple example, let's run it in interactive. And in order to do that, what I did was I did the keyboard shortcut. But you can also right-click and say, execute in interactive. And what this is going to do is open up a window. It's just really simple WPF control that just displays the numbers from that are in that list, so the numbers from 0 to 25. Now, I might want to I'll just show them in a different view, which is in a grid. And then what if I want to do some kind of operation on that? So in this case here, this is where we're using more of the power of an array expression. So here we're saying that for I in 0 to 25 in the range, as we had before, return I, and it's square. So if we run this, we'll see that this grid will show you each item in its square. And now we might want to do something more complicated. So for instance, what if we want to show only the even operators? The even numbers. So here we could filter out the functions where the mod is 0. And here I'm using this character, or this operator that you may not know. It's called the pipe operator. And what it does is it basically lets you put the argument before the function. And you can think of it as similar to a pipe on the command line in Unix, for instance, where you would, you know, pass a file and you could pipe it through a set of commands. So the way to think about it is if you had an expression where you had g of f of x, that it can really be expressed as f, and then apply f, and then apply g. So you get to write out the expression in the order in which you are applying the functions, rather than backwards, kind of, as you would have to do if you were using the regular parenthesized form. So that's one of the benefits of the sequence operator, and it turns out to be very, very useful in F# programs. It's very, very commonly used. So that was a very simple example. I showed you how to use lists, manipulate lists, but of course you would probably want to be able to use F# for real-world tasks. So let's get into that. So the title of the talk was about F# information-rich programming. And you may wonder what that means. To start out with, I'll give you some of the motivation behind why we designed this feature. So I'll start out with two pretty uncontroversial propositions. First, we live in an information society. Even over the past 5 years, the amount of data that you can get, the ease in which you can get it, has increased dramatically. And if you think about applications that were written 5 or 10 years ago, they didn't manipulate nearly as much data as they do now. Now you often see things that are going to Facebook, getting some data, or Twitter, or combining data from multiple sources. And so it's really changing the types of programs that you see out there. The problem, though, is that our languages are information sparse. So imagine that you were writing a program to parse some tweets from a Twitter stream. Now, your programming language doesn't know what a tweet is. It doesn't know what a hashtag is. It doesn't know what an at tag is. It doesn't know any of these things. And so usually, before you get started, you define these things. You define these concepts. And you have your own data structures. Now, the thing is, you have to do this for every single domain that you're working with. And we're used to doing this. And it's not so bad when you aren't connecting to many different data sources. But the problem is that you think about it, there's even more and more data sources out there. So every single time you're accessing a new type of data, you'd have to write out the schema by hand yet again. And because the number of data sources is ever increasing, and we're accessing more and more of them, this just becomes harder and harder and just less feasible to do this all by hand. So basically, the problem is that we have a statically typed language, and we have a schema in our database, but they don't line up. We have to basically manually get the schema from the database into our statically typed language. So one common approach is to use some kind of code generator tool, like the various tools that are in Visual Studio. Now, the tricky part is that each time you have a different kind of data source, you have to write a different code generator. So just integrating it into your IDE itself can be tricky. And then sometimes you have to integrate it into your build process. So it has to, connect to the database and generate the schema. And sometimes maybe your build system can't run the code generator. So then you generate the code ahead of time, and then maybe you put it into source control. But then you have to make sure that you don't edit the code, or people don't think that they can edit it, and the edits will stay. So it basically ends up being this extra piece that's different from the way you do your normal task. And it can cause all kinds of the problems like this. The other issue is that there isn't really an elegant way to handle schema change. So what you basically will end up having to do is know that your schema has changed, and then run the code gen tool again, and then build again. There's no way to kind of do it on demand, or for the database to tell you that it's changed, even. And this is just kind of an artifact of the fact that the code gen tool is something that's built on top of your programming language rather than integrated into your programming language. And the other issue is that sometimes, depending on whether or not you do code gen, you can end up losing type information. Sometimes you'll get some field from an object from a database, and it'll just have type object. And then you have to downcast it to the right thing. And sometimes it's even worse than that, and you just get some strings back, and you have to parse out fields. And this is really unfortunate, because when you have a statically typed programming language, you expect to be able to get the benefits of all aspects of static types, including a schema that might be in a data source. And when you have even more of this impedance mismatch, you will sometimes see that it's easier to connect to a data source using a dynamically typed language than a statically typed one, because they don't have to do extra work to get the types to line up. So it's really not what we want, because we want to be able to use the schema that's there and kind of bring it into our type system. And that's exactly what we've done with F# 3.0. And I'll talk a little bit about why this actually matters. I talked a bit about before how the number of data sources people are using increases. Let's look at this graphically. So just the number of APIs that are open, that are publicly open and publicly used, has increased exponentially over the past 5 years. And this is only a small fraction of the APIs that are out there. And many companies will make their data source available or have a private API if you're using their product. And it's just changing the types of programs that people are writing. So the way that we're solving this problem is with a feature called type providers. And you can think of it as providing IntelliSense for data, or more specifically, for your data schema. And let me give you an example that uses the Freebase database. Now, what's Freebase? It's an open source database. It has a graph structure. So you can see this image. You can go from, you know, just a few links to from, you know, Steve Jobs to the Academy Awards to Gregory Peck. And basically it interconnects many different types of data in its in this database. Now, it has a lot of entries, 22 million, in fact, and they're all very interconnected, as I said. So you can see that it would be pretty hard to code generate all of that schema. So let's see how it works with F#. So in F#, we have a Freebase type provider. And that what that does is that lets us get Freebase data into F#, and F# will then know what to do with it. So this is just a script to help view the results. And in order to connect to this data source, all I have to do is make a reference, you know, just a regular assembly reference to the Freebase type provider DLL. And then I just make a type alias that's the root of what that database provides, data source provides. And so if I run this in the interactive window, then I can start doing all kinds of interesting things. So for instance, let's say, let's just see what kinds of entities there are in this data source. So so if I press dot, I get American football, amusement parks, architecture, and all kinds of crazy things like law, internet, that kind of thing, IMDb even. So here I'm going to go into the celebrities section just because it's kind of interesting. And then I can press dot again, and you see it takes a little bit of time here because my connection here isn't that fast, it seems. And it's actually dynamically going to the web, pulling out the schema, and bringing it to me. And ordinarily, of course, it's a lot faster than this. So let's see if this will load. Now, you can also cache the schema. Now, this particular type provider tends to go out and get fresh data more often, but you can imagine putting things into a cache file or something like that. So let's see here. Let me escape out of this and try again. All right, here we go. So for a celebrity, you can see what substances they abuse, their criminal offenses, rehab facilities, what kind of romantic relationships they have. And you can also see all the kinds of strange things that you may not know what they are. Like, for instance, you can see a super couple, which is a popular financially wealthy pairing that captivates and intrigues its observers beyond normal expectations. So I kind of know what that is. Now, maybe I want to see what it looks like. So I'll just show the celebrity super couples in a grid. And this this control here is just really, really simple. It just uses reflection, and it pulls out the different fields from a record. And so you can see here when it's showing an image, that's actually the type of the field is an image. And most of the fields here are text. So we can see that it's got some interesting things like Bennifer and see Sonny and Cher, Ike and Tina, Posh and Bex, Tomcat, and, you know, Brangelina, all kinds of interesting things. So, now what if we wanted to do some kind of more complicated analysis over Freebase? Let's see what that would look like. First off, let's look at one of the data set sources that Freebase has, and that's fictional universes. Basically, there's a whole section of the database devoted to this. So that kind of tells you a little bit about the kinds of people who use Freebase and who add entries to it. So here I'm going to list the first 100 fictional universes that are in the Freebase data source. And so you can see there's some that you probably are familiar with, like the Buffyverse and the Xenaverse and Star Trek and all kinds of things like that. So I said before that this database is a graph database. It's very highly connected. So let's see if we wanted to do a query over that, what it would look like. So let's say the query that we want to answer is, who has created the most popular fictional universe? And essentially, we want to know, for the fictional universes that person has created, how many works were written for that or set there? And it doesn't necessarily have to be something that they wrote themselves. Something like Star Trek, for instance, has, you know, many spin-offs, and other people will write works for it. So the way we write this is we use this kind of query here. First off, we take every creator in the fictional universe, and we do a map operation, which basically means that we transform the sequence into a different sequence. And so here we take each creator, we pull out the name, and this is kind of using the tuple syntax, and then for each of the fictional universes that that person has created, we collect all of the works that were set there and basically take the length of that. So if we run this and show the results, we'll see that it's giving us some interesting data. So it's basically saying that George Lucas, according to its data, is the most popular fictional universe creator because most works have been written for it. Now you can also write this out as a query, which is very the F-sharp query expressions, which are very similar to link queries. And so here we're saying, take all the look for all the creators, you select the creator name, and then you sum up the works that were set there. And if you look at this query, you can see that it's actually very similar to what it would look like in C sharp. And this kind of points the query syntax kind of points to one of the benefits of type providers, which is essentially that you have this great syntax, which is link, for accessing data and for doing all kinds of operations on it. And now you have an easy way to get the schema. So link currently is very, very good for cases where you can do the code generation and where it knows about the type, the kind of thing that you're operating over. But adding new types to link is very tricky. And so if you have a schema that you can't do code generation for, like Freebase, you can use type providers and get all of the benefits of link without having to write your own link provider. So my set F-sharp is very concise. What would this same example look like in F-sharp? Well, here I have a very simple example where I'm creating a schema manually for a chemical element. And here I've pulled out three of the fields, the name, the boiling point, and the atomic mass. Now, these are just three of the fields that are associated with a chemical element. This isn't even modeling the whole entity there. Now, not only do I have to define the schema, but then I have to do all this code in order to get all the data and push it into the schema. And there's nothing here to make test that I did it correctly. Whereas with a type provider, you kind of write it all once, it pulls out the schema, uses that all, that format, and then when you're actually using it, it's all type safe. And if the schema changes, you just refresh your project, and you'll see that you maybe now have more squiggles than you did before, because it can go and fetch the data, the schema again, and tell you if your code is correct with respect to it. So in summary, you can program against web-scale schematized data. And that's something where code gen wouldn't work. And the advantage here is that you don't have to wait for the code gen or the code to compile. If you were going to do a code generation approach, let's say for a smaller database, first you would run the code gen, and then you'd have to compile everything in your program in order for it all to work. Now, with F-sharp type providers and the F-sharp interactive window, you just get started right away. And you saw that little bit of delay there, and that was because it actually pulled out the schema, and that was the only amount of delay that I had to wait. And you basically get everything that you want. You get type checking, you can detect schema change, and you get all of the great Visual Studio tooling and link queries and all that great stuff. Now, most of the data sources that people connect to aren't as big as Freebase, and they certainly aren't that interconnected. But you can imagine that if you have a database where you only want to access part of it, you don't want to pull down the whole thing. And you don't want to have to code gen everything and have code bloat and all of that. So even if your database is smaller, but say you're running on a small device and you want your code size to be smaller, it can be very beneficial not to have to do all this code generation. Now, that was just one data source, and that was kind of an application that you would see in a consumer app. But what about an enterprise scenario or a web service? What about when you want to have multiple data sources and you want to do some kind of processing over them? So in this example, imagine you have a web service where you want to advise people on where they should live based on their demographic information and where they work. And here, you can imagine that you put in your age and your income, your household size, and then it tells you, well, based on that, this is the right zip code for you. Now, how do we do this? So The first step, of course, is to get the data. And in order to do that, we're going to use the Azure Data Market. So we'll go to datamarket.azure.com. And here there's a number of data sources, both free and paid, that basically are it's kind of a marketplace for data. So here I'll type in census. And this is going to tell, this first one is the one I want. And this is just the US Census data from 2010. And it has a free one where I can use to get started. And if I scroll down here, it's going to tell me the details, which are, first off, this is the service root URL. If I go to some of the help pages, it'll say that I should use the OData protocol to connect to it. And then it's going to tell me about the different fields that are available. And so these are the ones that are listed. And here this table is just in text. And, you know, it's telling me that it's a string, but it's not actually, you know, putting it into my programming language. Now, remember these fields because we'll come back to them later. So in order to use this type provider, what I do is to use this data source with a type provider, I copy this URL, go to my program, and I just paste it in to the OData service. Now, I already had it here, so I'll just delete it and show you that it works. But the interesting thing is, so I took out that URL, and now I'm getting a bunch of squiggles because it actually is nothing to connect to. And so it, you know, looks for the schema. There's none there, so anything you tried to get off of that root is going to be non-existent. Now, I type in the URL again. It takes a couple of seconds. It retype checks, and you can see now it's saying, okay, everything is good. So some of the things that I can do off of that are, so if, for instance, if I dot off of the root of the type provider, I can get the data context, which tells me, for instance, here it doesn't set any credentials. And then I can look at the different types that it has with service types, which is basically the root that of the types that we saw earlier in that web page. And this is telling me a little bit about this. And it's saying that I might need to set the credentials property. And so then I set it down here. And the interesting thing is that the type provider is kind of walking me through the steps of what I need to do. I start out with this type, and I dot off of that, and I say, see, I can get a data context and the service types, and then I can just get started. And I don't have to, you know, learn another tool or run another tool and then compile in order to get started. So here I'm going to do a simple query that just pulls out all of the demographic information for the state here. I've hard-coded to be Washington and King County. And then I just sort by the zip code. And here I'm just pulling this into a list. So the inside of this is pretty simple. I'm just making my own data structure that kind of has different types, slightly different types. For instance, I don't have nullables in here. And I can create the list, again, by using this array expression. So I don't have to, I do have a loop here, but I don't have to have a separate loop in order to populate the list. And then I use the sequence operator again, and here you can see I'm sorting, the key I'm using is the concatenation of the city and the zip code. So this will end up sorting by city and then by zip code. Now, the next step is going to be to get the driving distance from each of these target zip codes to the person's work address. And in order to do that, I can use the Bing Maps API. And in order to get there, I could just go to a similar web page that kind of tells me what the service URIs are. And there's a separate API for the geo route service and the route service. So I have to set up two connections to that. And then I can just define some type abbreviations here. And then I just get started. And the code I write here is, of course, very similar to what I would write in C#. It's a bit more verbose. But the advantage of having type providers is that when I'm using this API, it might be new to me, and I might not know what I want to do. And so say I have a route service, and I want to know, well, what can I do on it? Well, this is telling me that I can calculate a route, for instance. Or I could do it asynchronously and wait for a result, get a task back. You could also calculate the routes using just major roads. So there's a lot of options here. And then when I get the result, I might want to know what kinds of things I can do. Well, one thing is to get a bounding rectangle in terms of coordinates. I can get the distance as I've done here, or I could take some other property, like the time in seconds. So it basically will tell me how long it will take to get from point A to point B. So I could refine my web service to take that into account in addition, to say, well, how long do you want your commute to be, both in miles and time? So I happen to have this the web service running, and here I have an MVC3 front end that's written in C# with an F# library as the back end. And in order to hook it all up, all I do from my controller in C# is I call into the F# DLL. So here, for instance, I'm calling this function that says find the best zip code, and then I also show the local businesses. And in order to do that, I used another service. Here I'm using the Bing search service, which happens to actually be a separate service from the route and geocode services. And here again, I can put in certain filters and get out the results. And so if I try out some of this, so for instance, I could print out, let's see, execute here. And I seem to have minor problems with my script, but let's look at the more interesting thing, which is to actually see it in action on the web page. So here the user can put in their age. Let's say I am just out of college, so I am 21 and I make $80,000. And let's say I have a roommate, two roommates, let's say, and so there's three of us, and I work at Microsoft. And I'm willing to drive 20 miles to work. And so I run the F# magic, and this is taking a little while because it actually is pulling out, it's calculating the driving directions for each zip code to that address that the user put in. And it's basically pinning the route service many, many times for all of the zip codes, the potential zip codes that the person might want to live in. So ordinarily, of course, in a real data service, you would cache this and, refresh the cache, say nightly or something like that. So in a second, this will come up. And let's see here. Let me make sure that it's running correctly. Oh, here we go, the results. So it's saying Mercer Island. This might mean my data is a little off because that is kind of an expensive place for someone to live. I was using a very simple matching algorithm, which I'll show you in a minute. But it's telling me what the zip code is. It's telling me about what the people are like who live there, what their average age is, how big the household is, how much the income growth is projected based on the census data. And then I can list some businesses that person might be interested in. So they're young. So here I have some clubs and some billiard parlors and some taverns and bars. And I could customize this, which I've done here. So for instance, let's say the person is actually 70, and let's make their income the same, and let's say they have a family of five, and it's gonna show me something different. Let's run the tool again. Again, it's taking a little while because it's hitting the web service. And basically what I'll do, the way I'm doing this is I'm setting up some search filters to return different businesses. So again, it's Mercer Island. I think that might be because of the income is kind of disproportionately highly matched. But it's going to tell me about different things like country clubs and theater. And it's not going to tell me about pool halls or anything like that. So let's make the income just a little bit lower and see, just so you can see that it actually does return different zip codes. And, this person that unfortunately is only making $20,000 and has five people in their family, this will tell you where people like that, people that are the closest to that, live. And this is a zip code in Seattle now, and you can see here the average household income is pretty close to that. Of course, the median age is a lot lower, so maybe this person wouldn't fit in so well here. But again, it's showing me country clubs, and there aren't any near there. So you can see how I was able to connect multiple different data sources, and even though different sources had different protocols, like one was WSDL and one was OData, I was able to connect to them all in a uniform manner. Basically, all of the built-in type providers that we have take in a URL, And for, say, a SQL server, you would have a connection string. And here, for an OData service, you have a URL. And I talked about the matching algorithm, which is a very, very simple one. But the matching that I used, if you write it out in math and then in F#, you'll see they map up very closely. And I'm using just a very simple metric, which is called the Manhattan distance, where basically I subtract each element of the vector from the other corresponding one, square it, multiply by the weight, sum, and then take the square root. And now the exact details of this formula aren't important, but if you look at the math, you can see that it is doing exactly the same thing on the right, except it's kind of reversed because it's doing it in the order in which the operations are applied rather than the way we write it in math. So here we say x1 minus y1, and that's the list map 2, so x minus y, and then we square them, and then you multiply by the weights, sum, and take the square root. So this is kind of points to why F# is very popular in the financial and scientific communities, because you might have a very complicated algorithm, but if you can write it out in a simple way, you're less likely to make a mistake. And it also makes it easier for other people to read what you've written. So to summarize, you can use type providers to program against multiple data sources. And like I said, they're all uniform. And you can write your own type provider. It doesn't even need to necessarily connect to a web server. There's a type provider for parsing regular expressions, for instance. You can write one for a CSV file. We have a type provider sample that just uses the WMI host and lets you do different kinds of different functions that you can access on your local machine. Like you can query how many processors you have or how much memory you have. And ordinarily, accessing all these things is very different. Each one of these things you do their own way, and you have to learn a specialized programming technique for each data source. But here, F# simplifies all that, and it works really well for the program logic. And we use C# on the front end, so we don't really have to change our workflow. The designer can design things the way they ordinarily do. Just the general click logic can be the same, but all the heavy lifting you do in the back end in F#. And just a little bit more about libraries and what you can do with them. We're also supporting portable libraries in this release, which lets you put the program logic in a reusable library. And when I say reusable, I mean you actually don't even have to recompile for different framework platforms. So for instance, you could have a library that you use in a Silverlight application. And here's an example of a spreadsheet program, for instance. And you could take that same exact library, you don't even have to recompile it, write a different front end and use it in a Metro application. So it kind of lets you reuse even more than ordinarily is possible. So I talked a lot about what you can do so far in F#. And we have, beta is out now, and the full version, Visual Studio, will be out soon. And, people might naturally be asking, well, what are we going to do next? Where is the language headed? Well, you may have heard, cloud is kind of an important thing. And F# is actually very well aligned with the cloud, because the data processing I was showing you, the list expressions, all of that, can map very well to cloud computation. And right now, for instance, you can program F# on Azure, but we don't have anything built into the language or the libraries that are specifically intended to make this easy, or basically any cloud service. But the advantage of F# is that there's a feature called computation expressions that basically let you add new syntax to the language, or it looks like new syntax, but it's actually just in a library. So for instance, you could imagine having a cloud expression that you put the code in there, and then the runtime figures out what to do with it and where to distribute it and how to get the response and all of that. And the async and query expressions in F# are actually not even built in syntax themselves, and they're using computation expressions as well. So there's a lot of flexibility here. We don't necessarily have to add a new keyword in order to get this stuff to work well. And I'll talk a little bit about what computation in the cloud might look like. So there's a new library called Cloud Numerics that is out in CTP form right now from the SQL labs. And it's basically a set of numerical algorithms, but a very, very extensive set. Lets you do all kinds of things, basic math, statistics, linear algebra, things that I'd never even heard of before. And the cool thing is that it lets you do this on the cloud. You can do it on the local machine as well. But the cool thing is, if you have a very large data set, you could distribute it actually over multiple machines or do some kind of complex matrix operation and in a distributed fashion, like you perhaps do part of the matrix in one host and the rest somewhere else, and then you combine the results. So you could test your application on a local machine, or if you don't have a very large data set, you can do it locally, and then you can deploy to Azure when you need more computational resources. So let me give you a demo of what this looks like. Now, what I'm going to do here is connect to the census data again. So I'm using type providers again, and I'm going to pull out some city information. Here I'll use California just to be different. And this is just some code to print things out. Then I can pull everything into an array. This is just some pretty straightforward code. What I have is actually going to be in kind of a record form, and the numeric algorithms, of course, will work on numeric arrays. So I turn it into float values so that the numerics library can manipulate it. And I can calculate the percentile. So there's this function called quantiles inclusive. It actually does all kinds of percentiles as well. You could pass in an argument of how many partitions to put the data into. And here I put in 100. So suppose that I am trying to figure out, where is this 1% I keep hearing about? Where do they actually live? If I'm going to stage a protest, or maybe I'm just curious. And so I'm going to write an F# script to figure this out. And so here I'll pull out the 99th in terms of the income and the house. So this is the column corresponding to the income, and here's the home values. And then I will filter out the zip code information that matches up with whatever is higher than that particular value. So here I will run this in the interactive window, and this warning is not important, and it'll run in a second. Now it's again taking a little while because it's pulling out all the census data. The actual numeric transform is very fast. So here we go. So here's our two pieces of data. So in terms of homes, these are the most expensive homes. I could sort here. That turns out, for some reason, they're all the same. I'm not quite sure why. And based on income, the richest people live in this particular zip code in San Francisco. But it turns out their houses aren't the most expensive. So these people are pretty, pretty expensive houses. So anyway, this is telling us what the census data says on these particular characteristics. So in summary, with F# 3.0, you get a lot of really awesome features. You can do information-rich programming, where the new features we're looking at are making the cloud even easier to access with F#. And I showed you an example of the Cloud Numerics Library, which works really well with F#. You can use actually from any .NET language and do your numeric computation in a distributed fashion. So I encourage you to download the beta release of Visual Studio 11 and kind of play around with F#. And check out the F# Developer Center for more resources. Thanks a lot. Thank you.